Wisdom, the final frontier to true knowledge. Welcome to Wisdom Trek, where our mission is to create a legacy of wisdom, to seek out discernment and insights, to boldly grow where few have chosen to grow before. Hello, my friend. I am Guthrie Chamberlain, your captain on our journey to increase wisdom and create a living legacy. Thank you for joining us today as we explore wisdom on our second millennium of podcast. Today is day 1531 of our trek, and it is Worldview Wednesday. Creating a biblical worldview is essential to have a proper perspective on today's current events. To establish a biblical worldview, you must have a proper understanding of God and His Word. This week, we will expand on the past course that we worked on as we continue reviewing the book from Dr. Michael S. Heiser titled Supernatural. The book is an abbreviated version of the more comprehensive book, The Unseen Realm. I highly recommend both of these books. Creating a biblical worldview is based on how the Old and New Testament connects with God's overall plan for humanity, and this is essential. This book review will help us to understand what the Bible teaches about the unseen world and why it matters. And today's chapter is Divine Rebellions. I ended last week's Worldview Wednesday episode with the thought that free will in the hands of imperfect beings, whether divine or human, can have disastrous results. That's an understatement. Some catastrophes in the early chapters of the Bible, all of them involving humans and supernatural beings, illustrate this point. Recall that God decided to share His authority with both divine beings in the supernatural world and with human beings on earth. That was the backdrop to God's statement in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, "Let us make humankind in our image," and the fact that God then created humans in His image. Spiritual beings and humans are imagers of God. We share His authority and represent Him as co-rulers. On the one hand, this was an excellent decision. Free will is part of being like God. We could not be like Him if we did not have it. Without free will, concepts like love and self-sacrifice die. If you merely are programmed to love, there is no decision in it. It isn't real. Scripted words and acts aren't genuine. Thinking about this takes me back to the last of the original Star Wars movies, The Return of the Jedi. The spirit of Obi-Wan Kenobi tells Luke his father, Darth Vader, is more machine than man. Yet in the end, we find that this isn't true. Vader saves Luke from the Emperor at the cost of his own life. Vader wasn't just a programmed machine. His decision came from his heart, his humanity, his own free will. But there is a dark side to God's decision. Granting intelligent beings freedom means that they can and will make wrong choices or intentionally rebel. That's guaranteed to happen. Since the only truly perfect being is God, He is the only one He can trust. Free will is why things could and did go wrong in Eden. There was trouble in paradise. Thinking about the setting in Eden, Adam and Eve aren't alone. God is there with His counsel. Eden is the divine/human headquarters for subduing the rest of the earth as instructed in Genesis chapter 1 verses 26 and 28. Humans are to spread the life of Eden to the rest of the planet. We learn that at least one member of the council isn't happy with God's plan. Just as we saw in Genesis 1, there are hints in Genesis 3 that Eden is home to other divine beings. In Genesis chapter 3 verse 22, after Adam and Eve have sinned, God said, "Behold, the man has become like one of us in knowing good and evil." That phrase is the same sort of sign point that we saw in Genesis chapter 1 verse 26 as our image. We know the main character in Genesis, the serpent, was not really a snake. He wasn't an animal. No effort to put him behind glass in a zoo has been effective, and he would not have been amused. He was a divine being. Revelation chapter 12 verse 9 identifies him as the devil or Satan. Some Christians presume, based on Revelation chapter 12 verses 7 through 12, that there was an angelic rebellion shortly after creation, and this is what it reads. "And there was a war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. And they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them any longer in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, the ancient serpent, who is called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was thrown down to earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. Revelation chapter 12, verses 7 through 9. A closer analysis of Revelation, we see that the war in heaven described there is associated with the birth of the Messiah. In the same chapter, Revelation chapter 12, verses 4 and 5 and verse 10. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, in order that whenever she gave birth to her child, he could be devoured. And she gave birth to a son, a male child, who is going to shepherd all the nations with an iron rod, and her child was snatched away to God and to his throne. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of God and the authority of his Christ have come, because the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, the one who accuses them before God day and night. Before the events of Eden, the Bible does not indicate that any of its imagers, human or divine, were opposed to God's will or were in rebellion. Circumstances changed dramatically in Genesis chapter 3. The serpent's crime was that he freely chose to reject God's authority. God had determined that Adam and Eve would join the family business, that is, his counsel. They would extend Eden to all the earth. The enemy didn't want them there. He put himself in the place of God. He said in his heart in Isaiah chapter 14, verse 13, I will ascend to heaven and set my throne above God's stars. I will preside on the mountain of the gods. He got a rude awakening. When the serpent's deception led to Adam and Eve's sin, he was expelled from God's home, Ezekiel chapter 28. And Ezekiel says, cut or cast down to the ground. In the biblical language of Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12, this is the place where death reigns, where life is not everlasting. Instead of being Lord of life, he became Lord of the dead, which meant that the great enemy now had claim over all humans, since Eden events meant the loss of earthly humanity. Humanity would now need to be redeemed to have eternal life with God in a new Eden. The fallout, pun intended, was a series of curses. The curse upon the serpent included a bit of prophecy. God said Eve's offspring and the serpent would be at odds, as we read in Genesis chapter 3, verses 14 and 15. Then Yahweh God said to the serpent, I will put hostility between you and between the woman, between your offspring and between her offspring. Who are Eve's offspring? Well, that's humanity. Who are the serpent's offspring? Well, that's a bit more abstract. The Apostle Paul gives us some examples, like the Jewish leaders who hated Jesus in John chapter 8, verse 44, you are of your father the devil. Jesus calls his betrayer, Judas, a devil in John chapter 6, verse 70. The serpent's offspring is anyone who stands against God's plan, just as he did. We really see that he was a bad seed. It didn't take long for more trouble to arise. One of Adam and Eve's children became a murderer. Cain killed Abel, showing that he was of the evil one, 1 John chapter 3, verse 12. As the human population grew in the biblical story, so did evil, Genesis chapter 6, verse 5. Now comes another supernatural transgression, although it may not be discussed much in Sunday morning sermons, which greatly impacted the expansion of wickedness on the earth. This time there was more than one rebel. The evil contagion spreading throughout humanity in Genesis chapter 6, verse 5, is linked to the story of Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 4, about the sons of God fathering their own earthly children, known as Nephilim. The Bible doesn't give us much else in Genesis about what happened. Still, pieces of the story show up elsewhere in the Bible and in Jewish tradition outside the Bible, the New Testament authors knew well and quoted in their writings. For example, Peter and Jude write about the angels who sinned before the flood, 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 4 through 6, and also Jude verses 5 and 6. Some of what they say comes from Jewish sources outside the Bible. Peter and Jude say that the sons of God who committed these transgressions were imprisoned under the earth, or in other words, they're doing time in hell until the last days. They'll be part of God's final judgment, something the Bible calls the Day of the Lord. Peter and Jude sources were well known to Bible scholars. One of them was a book called 1 Enoch. It was popular with the Jews of Jesus' day and with Christians in the early church, even though it wasn't considered sacred or inspired. Peter and Jude thought some of the content was important enough to include in their letters as they wrote. These sources speculate that the sons of God either wanted to help humanity by giving the divine beings knowledge and then got sidetracked, or they wanted to imitate God by creating their own imagers. They also include an explanation of where demons come from. Demons are the departed spirits of the Nephilim killed before and during the flood. They roam the earth harassing humans and seeking re-embodiment. In the books of the Bible that follow Genesis, descendants of the Nephilim of Genesis chapter 6 verses 1 through 4 are called Anakim and Rephaim, Numbers chapter 13 and Deuteronomy chapter 2. Some of the Rephaim showed up in the underworld realm of the dead, Isaiah chapter 14 verses 9 through 12, where the serpent was cast down. New Testament writers would later call this place hell. These ideas show us that the early writers understood the great threat of Genesis chapter 6 verses 1 through 4. The sons of God were trying to reformulate Eden, where the divine and human coexisted in their own way. They presumed to know better than God what should be happening on earth, just like the original enemy had. Alteration of God's plan to restore his rule ends up making a bad situation worse. Not only was the episode of Genesis chapter 6 verses 1 through 4 a terrible echo of the seed of the serpent, deliberate opposition to God, but was to preclude worse things to come. During Moses and Joshua days, some of the opponents they run into when trying to claim the promised land were scattered giant clans, Deuteronomy chapters 2 and 3. These giants went by various names. In Numbers chapter 13, they were called Anakim. They are specifically said to be living descendants of the Nephilim, the offsprings of the sons of God back in Genesis chapter 6 verses 1 through 4. The Old Testament tells us Israelites were fighting these oversized enemies until David's time. He took out Goliath in 1 Samuel chapter 17, and some of the men killed Goliath's brothers and finally ended the threat in 2 Samuel chapter 21. But why does this matter? The prophetic curse on the serpents and the divine transgressions that followed are the early stages of what theologians call spiritual warfare, the battle between good and evil, the long war against God and his people. It's a war fought on battlegrounds in two realms, the seen and the unseen. As strange as these stories are, they teach us an important lesson. God had divine competition when it came to human destiny. He still does. Opposition to God's will for earth and humanity is alive and well, in both the spiritual realm and within humankind. God has his own plans for how heaven and earth will be unified. Hostile interferences won't go unpunished. Humanity is too valuable. God's own plan for his human family won't be altered or overturned. These passages also teach us positive lessons. While the long war against God can be tracked back to God's decision to create imagers, human and divine, who would share his attributes of freedom, God is not the cause of evil. There is no hint in the Bible that God prodded his imagers to disobey or that their disobedience was predestined. The fact that God knows the future doesn't mean it's predestined. We know that for sure from passages like 1 Samuel chapter 23 verses 1 through 14, which tells us of a time where David saved Keilah's walled cities from the Philistine. After the battle, Saul learned that David was in the city. Saul had been trying to kill David for some time out of paranoid fear that David would take his throne. Saul sent his army to Keilah, hoping to trap David within the city walls. When David heard about Saul's plan, he asked God in 1 Samuel chapter 23 verses 11 and 12, "Will the leaders of Keilah betray me to him? And will Saul actually come as I have heard? O Lord, God of Israel, please tell me." And the Lord said, "He will come. Yes, they will betray you." David then did what any of us would do. He got out of the city as fast as possible. That tells us why God's foreknowledge of the events doesn't mean that they are predestined. 1 Samuel chapter 23 has God knowing two events that actually never took place. That God foreknew that there would be a divine rebellion and human failure doesn't mean that he made those things to happen. Foreknowledge doesn't require predestination. We need to view these events in the fall of this light. God knew Adam and Eve would fail. God wasn't surprised because he knows all things real and possible. The fact that God foresaw the entrance of evil and rebellion in his world on the part of both humans and the divine rebel who seduced humanity to rebel doesn't mean that he caused it. We can and should view the evil we experience in our own lives and times in the same way. God foresaw the fall and was ready with a plan to rectify it. He also knew we would be born sinners and fail, and quite honestly, we fail a lot. He didn't predestine those failures. When we sin, we need to own our sin. We sin because we choose to. We can't say God willed it and that we had no choice because it was predestined. God loved us as we are told in Romans chapter 5 verses 6 through 8. God showed his great love for us by sending Christ to die for us while we were still sinners. He loved us despite knowing what we would do. He not only gave us freedom to sin, he gave us freedom to believe the gospel and to live for Jesus. God also knows, and we know by experience, bad things happen to people, even to Christians. Evil is in this world because people and divine beings have the freedom to do evil. Our God isn't a twisted deity who predestines awful things or needs horrible crimes of sin to happen so some greater plan can work out well. God doesn't require evil, period. His plans will move forward despite it, overcoming it, and ultimately judging evil. We might ask why God just doesn't eliminate evil right now. There's a reason. For God to eliminate evil, he would have to eliminate his imagers, human and divine, who are not perfect like he is. That would solve the problem with evil, but it would mean that God's original idea to create other divine agents and human beings to live and rule with him was a huge mistake, and God doesn't make mistakes. We might also wish that God had never given humans freedom, but where would we be then? In choosing to provide us with freedom, God also chose us not to make us mindless slaves or robots. That's the alternative to having free will. Since freedom is an attribute we share with God, we couldn't actually become imagers of God without it. God is no robot, and he made us like himself. That wasn't a mistake either. God loved the idea of humanity too much to make an alternate decision. After evil entered the world, he devised a means to redeem humanity, renew Eden, and wipe away every tear. Revelation chapter 7, 17 and 21 verse 4. Our look at the long war against God is underway. God has a battle strategy. The situation in Eden is going to get worse before he makes his first move. And that will finish our study for this week on Worldview Wednesday. Join us again next week as we continue building our biblical worldview. Tomorrow we will enjoy a 3-minute humor nugget that will provide you with a bit of cheer, which will help you to line up and live a rich and satisfying life. So encourage your friends and family to join us and to come along with us tomorrow for another day of Wisdom Trek, Creating a Legacy. If you'd like to listen to any of the past 1,530 treks or read the Wisdom Journals, they are all available at wisdom-trek.com. And I encourage you to subscribe to Wisdom Trek on your favorite podcast player so that each day's trek will be downloaded to you automatically. And thank you so much for allowing me to be your guide, your mentor. But most importantly, I am your friend as I serve you through the Wisdom Trek podcast and journal each day. And as we take this trek of life together, let us always live abundantly, love unconditionally, listen intentionally, learn continuously, lend to others generously, lead with integrity, and leave a living legacy each day. I am Guthrie Chamberlain, reminding you to keep moving forward, enjoy your journey, and create a great day every day. See you tomorrow.